WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We've been hearing from certain politicians about the need for tort reform. They say we need reform because people are litigation happy, seeking a quick and easy payday at the expense of businesses that have allegedly hurt them in some way. Tort reform is also touted as a way to reduce the cost of medical care, which is high in part, we are told, because of the cost of defending doctors and medical institutions from frivolous lawsuits. Perhaps the poster child for frivolous lawsuits is the case of the elderly woman who sued a fast food restaurant after going through a drive-thru, ordering hot coffee, and, when they served her, spilling it in her lap. She sued them because the coffee was too hot. It burned her. Proponents of tort reform point to that as an egregious example of what's wrong with the system. But are they giving us the whole story? Susan Saladoff didn't think so. She spent 25 years practicing law in the civil justice system, representing injured victims of individual and corporate negligence. She stopped practicing law in 2009 to make the documentary Hot Coffee. It premiered at the 2011 Sundance Film Festival and had its broadcast premiere that same year on HBO. It is being screened in Charlotte at the Epicenter Theater tonight at 7, and we thought that would be a good jumping-off point for a discussion on the topic. Saladoff joins us here in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Nice to have you in Charlotte. Also joining us by phone is Ted Frank. He is an adjunct fellow with the Manhattan Institute Center for Legal Policy and editor of their web magazine, pointoflaw.com, and a man the Wall Street Journal has called a leading tort reform advocate. He is also a former scholar with the American Enterprise Institute. He joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And again, in our studios, Bobby Jenkins, an attorney who practiced law in the area of medical negligence, product liability, wrongful death, and serious personal injury for a dozen years before joining the faculty of the Charlotte School of Law. He also teaches pretrial litigation at the University of North Carolina School of Law. Thank you for joining us as well.
It's good to be here.
This documentary was on television last year on HBO, and now it's at the Epicenter Theater tonight. I understand that you were actually a practicing attorney who did quit to make this film. Is that accurate?
Well, I was planning to only take a one-year sabbatical, but that was 3.5 years ago.
Now, why was this so important to you that you would give up a practice of law to make? And had you ever done anything like this before?
I hadn't. I had made a few films about clients for cases, you know, where I would do what they call a day in the life film of my clients. But I'd never taken on any type of project in this magnitude in the film industry. In fact, I had never made a documentary before. But I was, and frankly, I wasn't planning to become a filmmaker. I loved what I was doing, but I knew that most people did not understand the civil justice system until they needed it, that most people didn't even think about it or care about it until, unfortunately, something happened to them or a family member, and then all of a sudden they needed to access the court system, and they realized for the first time that it wasn't there for them anymore, because we as Americans have been giving up our constitutional rights to access the court system for years, and we don't know about it because nobody wants to think about our courts.
What do you mean we've been giving up our constitutional rights? What does that mean?
So, for example, we sign contracts every day. We sign contracts when we buy a car, when we get a mortgage, when we use our cell phone, or when we use a credit card. We are agreeing to a contract. And in those contracts now is something called mandatory arbitration. And people would gloss over their eyes when they hear those terms. But what it means is that if you ever have a dispute with this company that you've now agreed with this mandatory arbitration, they get to pick the decision maker. They pay for the decision maker. The decision maker doesn't have to give a reason why he or she comes up with the decision. It's completely secretive and there's no right to appeal. Now, that's giving up your constitutional rights to access the court system to get a jury trial. And nobody even thinks about it or cares about it when they're signing these contracts. Every single thing you buy online, you know, you have to sign that little box that says, I agree to the terms. Who reads it? Nobody, because you can't buy the product if you don't sign it. And why would you even bother? You wouldn't understand it anyway. And every time you do that, you're giving away your constitutional rights.
How has this happened, this creep of loss of rights. Why is it happening?
Well, it's been happening for years. It's been happening over the last 25 to 30 years in various ways, which is what I show in the film, because I show actually in the film four storylines.
Right, right.
And each one represents a different way that we're giving up our rights. And why has it been happening? Because large corporations understood years ago that the only place where they would be held accountable for products that harm people, for when they pollute our waters and our air, is in the court system. Big Tobacco actually started this because they were making a product that was killing people, and they knew that the only place they could be held accountable is in our civil courts. So they figured out ways over the years to prevent people from getting into the courts, and if they do get into the courts, to put limitations on what they can get in the courts. Why? So that they can make more money.
Ted Frank, as an advocate for tort reform, I would imagine you see this from a different point of view.
Well, absolutely. I mean, nobody is being forced to give up a right. It's a voluntary contract.
Is it? Hold on. If you want to buy the product and you don't sign the contract, can you buy the product?
That's no different than anything other term in the contract. I can't force Apple to sell me a red iPhone either. I mean, that doesn't mean that my right to a red iPhone has been violated. It means that there's a that we in the free market, we have made a deal. And through mandatory arbitration clauses, and I won't defend every mandatory arbitration clause. There are good mandatory arbitration clauses. There are bad mandatory arbitration clauses. But the point of a mandatory arbitration clause is to protect both consumers and sellers from unfair class action litigation that costs consumers money. And it allows sellers to sell their products at a lower price. And that benefits consumers, and lawyers don't like that because they prefer a class action system that permits them to extract money from consumers and have that sort of wealth transfer from middle-class consumers to wealthy trial lawyers. But they're fighting very hard to keep consumers from having the choice to agree not to participate in that system. And we, quote-unquote, give up rights all the time. When you get married, you're giving up the right to have promiscuous sex with other people. You commit yourself in advance because the benefits of the contract outweigh the costs. You, for example, you have a contract with your employer not to disclose secrets of the employer. That's not a losing your right to free speech. It's a recognition that you're both better off if the employer can pay you money and keep it secret.
Bobby Jenkins is here from the Charlotte School of Law, and we asked you to be here as a kind of referee, a neutral party in the center of this conversation.
Well, wait a second. I want to protest the idea that he's a neutral referee. He's okay. A member of the trial lawyer. He was on the Board of Governors of the Trial Lawyers Association in North Carolina and lobbied against tort reform there. And I'm happy to do this two against one, but he's not a neutral referee.
Well, but now that your comment assumes that I can't look at it objectively, even though I might have an opinion about it.
Objectively, but I think
so. In other words, any lawyer, because lawyers, your point of view, despite the fact that he was a member of the Trial Lawyers Association, any lawyer you would say would be tainted in their opinion because they could profit from a lack of tort reform. Is that what you're saying, Ted Frank?
No, sir. I'm saying that he's previously stated his opposition to tort reform. And not that anybody's a lawyer. I'm a lawyer. I represent plaintiffs, and I've recovered millions of dollars for plaintiffs.
Okay.
I recognize that tort reform is needed to prevent the cost that the excessive litigation is imposing on our economy.
Give us your point of view then, Bobby Jenkins, on why you were against and are, I'm assuming still are, against tort reform.
Well, first, that's a rather broad statement to say just being against tort reform as opposed to looking at it from the specific components or the specific proposals that are brought forward. For example, there's been the introduction and the discussion of arbitration. And in my opinion, arbitration in and of itself is not necessarily a bad system and a bad process. For example, when I was practicing law, I, on numerous occasions in medical negligence cases, suggested to the defense attorney that let's arbitrate this case. I never got a bite. I never got a defense attorney to say yes, even though mandatory arbitration is often mentioned as part of tort reform. So that process in and of itself, I don't think, is bad. The question becomes, are the arbitrators, are the decision makers neutral?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the real decision, that's where the real issue comes, is can you do it in a neutral way?
Well, Susan mentioned that in these situations where you sign these contracts, where you're binding yourself to mandatory arbitration, should something go awry down the road, that the arbitrator is hired by, paid by, the company with whom you've signed the contract. Are they then officially, legally working for the company, or are they working to be a neutral party?
You know, that's going to depend on the situation. It's going to depend on the arbitrator himself or herself. Obviously, the point that's made in the movie, and one that is certainly worthy of debate, is if the arbitrator is getting repeat business, obviously you're not getting the repeat business from the consumer, mm-hmm. and does that impact the arbitrator's decision and in some way, shape, or form make the arbitrator less than neutral? What people want in our system in general, one of the reasons that the jury system is argued for is because of the sense that jurors are an unbiased, impartial panel to make the final decision. The question in these mandatory arbitration cases is, can the arbitrators truly be impartial if their future work and their future livelihood is dependent on continuing to be hired by the very company that instituted the mandatory arbitration provision?
The movie that kicked off this conversation, Hot Coffee, is called Hot Coffee for a reason. It's based on that famous case that I think almost anybody knows something about. But there are, as you say, three other cases. Why did you hang it on the coffee case?
Well, it's actually funny. Originally, the movie wasn't going to be called Hot Coffee. The movie was going to be called Distorted. Distorted has justice been sold, until I realized that nobody knows what a tort is, so they wouldn't get the joke. And I didn't think people would actually come to see a movie called Distorted. And then when I started researching what I wanted to do, I read an article that said that the McDonald's coffee case is the most famous case in the world. I would actually call it infamous, but that literally everybody knows it or thinks they know it. And I knew that most people had it wrong, that they didn't know it.
You start with some comments from people at the top of the film. You have clips of various people telling you what they know or what they think they know about what happened.
I got this picture in my mind that she actually pulled up, maybe took the coffee, and dumped it.
I think she went through the drive-thru.
She was driving the car.
Tried to drive and drink it at the same time.
And then the lid might have popped open and it spilled on her lap.
Had it between her legs.
Spilled in her lap. It was too hot.
And then sued McDonald's
for millions of dollars.
None of that is true.
None of it is true.
So what did happen? Interesting. What did happen?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. But what's really interesting about that is the night that the verdict came out, Jane Pauley was sitting in for Tom Brokaw in the NBC Nightly News, and she reported to the world the inaccurate facts. And that's just amazing to me. So what happened? This woman was 79 years old. Her name was Stella Liebeck. She had never brought a lawsuit a day in her life. She was a passenger in a parked car. Her grandson was driving. They went through the McDonald's to get a McBreakfast sandwich. She ordered coffee through the drive-thru. They put it in a bag with cream and sugar in the bag. And it wasn't the kind of cups we have today. It was one of those old-fashioned styrofoam cups with the little flat plastic top. You could never get that triangular thing off on the top.
Right.
And it held the heat. They pulled into a parking spot, parked the car. There were no cup holders in the car, so she steadied it to try to open that little thing to put the cream and sugar in and couldn't get it open, so she pulled the top off. And the coffee was so hot, it was between 180 and 190 degrees Fahrenheit. And as a result, the cup literally collapsed and the coffee pooled in her lap. It caused third-degree burns, which are the worst kinds of burns you can have. And I can tell you more about it after the break.
We'll come back and talk more about this, and we'll talk significantly about that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and 123NC.com, providing North Carolina with instant access to online criminal records for over a decade. Criminal records can be searched online at 123NC.com. And GAA Classic Cars Auction. Everyone welcome. Details at GAAClassicCars.com. You may be looking at the calendar and thinking to yourself, I'm sure you are, it's the time of year for ghosts. Yeah. Halloween, of course, is just around the corner. And we're talking about ghosts, not only those at Halloween, but those in literature and in movies. Those are just imaginary, right? Well, there are those who say that ghosts are real because we create them all the time. We'll let our guests tomorrow explain that philosophy, but I can tell you that it has to do with neurophysiology. So we'll get into a little bit of that, and then we'll also talk about the imaginary ghosts in film tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, thousands have been exposed to deadly fungal meningitis from tainted steroid injections, what the outbreak reveals about regulations and oversight of compounding pharmacies, and the risk to public health.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about tort reform through the lens of a camera that focuses in on hot coffee. That's the name of the HBO documentary produced, directed, and I guess conceptualized by our guest today, Susan Saddledoff. She's in our Spirit Square studio with Bobby Jenkins, an attorney and assistant professor at the Charlotte School of Law. And Ted Frank is on the phone from Washington, an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute's Center for Legal Policy and an advocate for tort reform. You were in the middle of the hot coffee story, and the fact we just illustrated the fact that everybody knows about this case, but they really don't know the accurate details, and it's not their fault. The media has not particularly portrayed it accurately over time, and people got their information from various different sources, not just the media, but from comedians and people. This was great fuel for comedic fodder.
So Jerry Seinfeld did an entire episode on it where Kramer spilled coffee and went to the Jackie the lawyer. So just to finish what I was saying earlier, so she was in a parked car. The coffee spilled in her lap. It was so hot that it caused third-degree burns, which are the worst kinds of burns that you can have, within 3 to 7 seconds of contact. And even though she tried to get out of the coffee, she couldn't get out of it fast enough. She wound up having skin grafting and surgery. And all she asked for from McDonald's was the difference between what her medical bills were and what Medicare paid. And McDonald's offered her $800, never offered her another penny. They went to trial. It was a unanimous verdict. The jury did find her 20% at fault. It was a comparative negligence state, which means that they could hold how much percentage each would. But they found her 20%, but McDonald's 80% at fault because McDonald's put on a quality assurance representative who testified, number one, they knew that the coffee that they were selling would cause third-degree burns on contact, and they also had paid out over 700 times for other people who had been burned by this coffee, and they never reduced the temperature. And the verdict, which people think was so crazy, was 2 days of coffee sales for McDonald's, which the judge then reduced to a much smaller number, and then they wound up settling the case. But then she was subject to a gag order and couldn't talk about it. But McDonald's wasn't subject to a gag order and was able to put out like all of this information.
Well, McDonald's was subject to a gag order. They couldn't talk about what they settled for. And she could have talked about the case. She just couldn't talk about what she settled for. There's a lot of factual inaccuracies here because McDonald's wasn't selling coffee at any temperature different than what Burger King or Wendy's or Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks sells coffee at. In fact, Starbucks sells its coffee at a higher temperature.
Actually, Starbucks, if you get Starbucks coffee at extra hot, it's 160 degrees. This coffee was being sold between 180 and 190 degrees.
That's false. Starbucks gets sued for third-degree burns all the time. And let me be clear. You know, this woman was actually injured. She did suffer really bad injuries. I am not disputing that, and people who do dispute that are in the wrong. If a McDonald's employee had poured a cup of coffee in Stella Liebeck's lap, I think McDonald's should be liable. But what happened here is that Stella Liebeck poured a cup of coffee in her own lap. And she did so and sat in it for 90 seconds, and that's, you know, she's elderly, she's not spry, she couldn't get out in time. And that's why she suffered really bad burns. She also suffered really bad burns because she was wearing cotton sweatpants, and the cotton sweatpants held the coffee to her skin. If she was wearing Gore-Tex, she would not have been injured.
So that means when we drink McDonald's coffee, we all have to wear Gore-Tex to protect ourselves?
Of course not, but you have to be careful. And that doesn't make McDonald's liable any more than it makes the car company liable for not having a cup holder or the sweatpants manufacturer liable for not protecting people against hot coffee. It's in the movie itself, you see a picture of the coffee cup, and Ms. Saladoff talks about, she says the cups, but the claim in the lawsuit is not the cup was defective. The claim in the lawsuit
Well, the original claim was also that the cup was defective. They actually they withdrew that claim, but the original claim was a products claim as well against the cup manufacturer.
And they withdrew that because they couldn't prove that the cup was defective. But
so you want to retry the case. You want to be the jury, right?
No, I want the courts to throw it out, as every other court that looks at this sort of claim looks at the claim, and they say it doesn't belong in a jury. Coffee is supposed to be hot. You, Stella Liebeck, are arguing that anything sold above 140 degrees, and that was the claim by the lawyer, anything above 140 degrees is unreasonably dangerous. That was the claim. The other claim was that McDonald's failed to warn her of the dangers of hot coffee. Because Stella Liebeck, despite the fact that she was 79 years old, apparently didn't know that hot coffee could injure her. And every other court that looks at this throws this out. This judge let it get to a jury. The jury saw some really ugly pictures of third-degree burns. And anybody who sees pictures of any lawyer can tell you, jurors don't normally see third-degree burns. Third-degree burns look very, very ugly, and they show them in the movie. And you see them and you're shocked and you're appalled,
Bobby,
and you want to punish somebody. But that doesn't, at the end of the day, whose fault is it? And the answer is, Stella Liebeck spilled the coffee on herself.
We'll come back to personal responsibility. Bobby Jenkins.
Yes, one of the things that comes to mind as I hear the exchange about the facts is one of the underlying things people need to understand is in our civil justice system, that fundamental right, that fundamental constitutional right we have is that when there is a dispute as to the facts, we allow a jury to decide those facts and then to apply those facts to the law. So the sides can argue about what the facts were, what the reality was. If you're going to assess the case, and I watched the documentary for the first time this morning, actually, but I've used the McDonald's coffee case as a teaching tool for years. And what I do with it with my class is make the point to them that if you're going to assess what the jury did, you can only do so in context of the evidence and the information that was presented to the jury, and then in context of the law that the judge gave to the jury and asked them to apply to those facts. And so we can argue about what the facts were and whether they should be – whether they should.
We're not complaining about the facts other than that Ms. Saladoff doesn't tell us the facts. She doesn't tell us that when McDonald's paid other people – the 1 in 23 million people who hurt themselves on coffee, that they were paying cases where the McDonald's employees spilled the coffee on the customer.
I really don't understand where you're getting that information from at all. And the what I'm confused by and can I speak for a minute? The movie is about the jury system. The movie is about our third branch of government, which is our courts and our democracy, and whether or not we believe in the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution, which is trial by jury. I'm not here, Mr. Frank, today to debate with you whether the jury got it right or not. It was a unanimous jury, and the question is, in our democracy, do we believe in the jury system? Do you believe in the jury system?
One of the things that comes across in this film quite clearly is that the courts system, the judicial system, is the only branch of government that ordinary people have access to, because the other two branches of government, the legislative branch, the Congress, and the executive branch, the president, are far removed and worse, controlled by big money interests, because it costs so much to get elected. Congress people are out raising money every day, and that money is coming to some degree from ordinary people like you and me, but the bulk of it is coming from corporate interests. So the only place where you have a redressive
group, lawyers contribute a heck of a lot.
I didn't say they didn't.
People elected, and you know, they're as much a special interest as anybody else. And
well, how about hold it? One of the things that gets lost in all of our political conversations recently, because all we're being told by politicians these days is the importance of business and how important business is. When did we lose the idea of citizenship and one man, one vote, and the right to redress grievances using the governmental system to do so? And that seems to be being lost.
How is it being lost? Nobody's losing it.
Because corporations are people, sir. Maybe you haven't heard the Supreme Court say that.
And also, at this point, one of the storylines in the film is also about judicial elections. It's the third storyline, and it's about a Mississippi State Supreme Court justice who was targeted for defeat by the U.S. By the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because he wasn't pro-corporate enough. And he wound up being attacked viciously both in the campaign and then when he won, there were these false criminal charges brought against him because they wanted to get him off the bench. And so the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is not a government entity, it is the largest lobbying group for corporations in the country, maybe perhaps in the world, is now putting massive amounts of money into judicial races, which are judges. The judges who make the decisions are at our state level in the most important decisions in our states, at our state Supreme Court justices. They're essentially being bought and paid for by large corporate interests right now. And so what that
argument, those justices were originally bought and paid for by the Trial Lawyers Association, that because that is what the Chamber of Commerce did, was we have all these judges on the bench who are bought and paid for by the Trial Lawyers Association. Let's get some people on the bench who actually follow the law rather than transfer wealth from middle-class Americans to wealthy trial lawyers. And, you know, you can argue whether or not judges should be elected. I think there are good arguments both ways on that. But the fact that that people were complaining about trial lawyer-elected judges, and you never hear in the movie the fact that the trial lawyers started this, that they took over the judicial election process. They took over the judicial selection process in cases where, in states where there weren't elections and there was a committee doing the selecting. And you end up with these judges who make these plaintiff-friendly rulings that that just violate defendants' constitutional rights to a fair trial and to a reasonable system of law where people can defend themselves.
One of the other things that is brought up in this movie is the genesis of this push toward tort reform, and I'm not sure that's necessarily fair because I don't have all the facts. I'm going by what's in the movie, and it dates back to – some of it dates back to Karl Rove, who worked for the tobacco industry and was, I guess, very successful in getting a lot of their desires pushed through for years to come, and then moved himself into politics with George W. Bush in Texas and later with George W. Bush on his way to the White House, who then in turn, as governor of Texas and as president of the United States, worked also in to a certain degree for tort reform. And made it a political issue, and one that was pretty easy to frame when cases like the hot coffee case come along. And if you don't have the facts in the hot coffee case, if you don't understand what really happened in the hot coffee case, it is very easy to, it seems to me, to make fun of it and to think that we're going down the road to perdition by allowing somebody who should know better at 79 years old, who spills hot coffee in her lap and is burned, to allow her to get a multimillion-dollar settlement in all of this.
Well, she actually didn't get a multimillion-dollar settlement. She wound up getting just a few $100,000.
Okay. But if you're 79 years old and you've lived your whole life with hot coffee, to not know that spilling hot coffee in your lap may cause you to be burned, that makes it very easy to push tort reform in a case like this, unless you, I guess, sit on the jury and understand what actually happened or come to a determination that the impressions out there are not accurate. But what should McDonald's do? I mean, should they serve only cold coffee? There was a hot coffee warning on the cup. There are now even more, I think, even larger hot coffee warnings on cups because of this case. What should a business that sells hot food products or a product that could harm you if used improperly do? What should they do?
Well, first of all, I don't think that it's reasonable to sell coffee through a drive-thru. No, I mean, now this is me coming now and taking the place of the jury, okay, because I wasn't sitting on the jury. But if, for me personally, I don't think it's reasonable to sell coffee or any product through a drive-thru where you know people are going to be moving that you also know will cause third-degree burns within 3 to 7 seconds.
Why not let consumers make that choice? The consumers who want to risk having a cup of coffee in the car can have the cup of coffee in the car.
I don't think that people expect that when they get a cup of coffee and they spill it on themselves, because we all spill things on ourselves, that we're going to need skin grafting and surgery.
All right. Now, what happens if you – in this case – hold on just a second. In this case, she was not the driver. She was the passenger. They did pull over and park because there were no cup holders and there were no level surfaces in the car on which to put the cup. It was an older car. But suppose the driver had been the one consuming the coffee, and they did not pull over, and they pulled out into traffic, and they took a sip, and it was so hot it burnt their mouth, and they in the process then dropped the cup of coffee, which caused more burns and caused them to be distracted and caused them to have an accident. Would then McDonald's be responsible for the accident?
You know, this is all about the civil justice system, which means that torts are about what's reasonable under the circumstances. That's what it's about. And a jury gets to decide, based on after both sides give their point of view, whether or not the conduct was reasonable under the circumstances. And, you know, you and I may have different opinion about that, but you get 12 people to decide whether or not selling coffee that the quality assurance representative testifies to at trial mm-hmm. will cause third-degree burns, which, again, are the worst kinds of burns that you can have, within 3 to 7 seconds of contact. It's interesting. The lawyer who actually represented McDonald's, she wouldn't go on the record when I asked her whether she would testify, I mean, whether I could interview her for the film. But she did wind up talking to me off the record for a couple hours. But one of the things that she said, which I don't think I'm violating any confidence, is that she went to a McDonald's after the verdict and, without thinking about it, took a sip of the coffee and burned her throat. And she was thought the irony of that.
Let me ask Bobby Jenkins and Ted Frank about that. The coffee at McDonald's, and I believe the film asserts that the coffee, the manual, the franchise manual that tells the franchisees what product quality should be, says that the McDonald's coffee should have been at 180 to 190 degrees Fahrenheit. They had other people who had experienced problems because of the hot nature of the coffee. They knew about it. I think they had some settlements, or so there were lists and lists and lists in the movies of in the movie of highlighted cases in which there had been problems. They knew about this. Starbucks has been mentioned in this conversation. They also serve hot coffee. Anybody who serves hot coffee serves hot coffee. Does hot coffee have to be at 180 degrees? And if you are a business that has repeated problems with a food product being sold at a particular temperature, would it not behoove you, is it not your responsibility to lower the temperature of the coffee? I want to hear from Bobby Jenkins first.
The question from the legal analysis is a question of reasonableness, as was said, and reasonableness under the circumstances and reasonableness in context of what is foreseeable. So McDonald's selling hot coffee. If at 180 degrees that coffee has the ability to cause severe burns very quickly, then the question McDonald's would face, again, from a legal analysis, and this is what I hope a first-year law student would do if they were dealing with this question, is whether it was reasonable under the circumstances to sell that coffee and to do so at that temperature and to do so through a drive-through when it is clearly foreseeable that someone buying that in a drive-through will attempt to either drink it in the car or, before drinking it, will attempt to add cream, add sugar, doctor it up in some way, mm-hmm. right? And so then in the legal context, it is as opposed to doing it in the abstract of do you sell 180-degree coffee, the question is, was it reasonable to sell that coffee at that temperature under the circumstances given what the foreseeable consequences could be? If McDonald's chooses to do that under our system, they are free to do so. But a consumer would also be free, at least as we stand now, to bring a lawsuit to address that.
I want to get Ted Frank's opinion on that, but I have to take a break. We'll do that on the other side. Mr. Frank, and I want to talk about some of the other cases and instances of loss of ability to address grievances to the court system that are brought up in this movie, Hot Coffee, when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFA. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Man Travel, 6th annual luxury travel show at the Duke Mansion tomorrow, 5 to 7 p.m., with 18 luxury travel company representatives available on site. Details at mantravels.com/luxury. And North Carolina Dance Theater's performance of Limitless Ballet pushes limits in a collection of 3 electrifying dance premieres, October 25th through 27th at the Knight Theater. Tickets available at ncdance.org. Thousands of people may have been exposed to deadly fungal meningitis from tainted steroid injections for back and neck pain. what the outbreak reveals about regulations, oversight of compounding pharmacies, and risks to public health. That's the topic in 20 minutes at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. Join our conversation at 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online, wfae.org/charlottetalks.
With All Things Considered, you can turn your ride home into an escape, exploring a world beyond the headlines. All Things Considered finds stories you haven't heard, interesting perspectives, innovative ideas, and voices beyond the ordinary. Join us for something new and unexpected every afternoon. It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekdays from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about tort reform through the eyes of Hot Coffee, a movie that was on HBO last year. It's being screened tonight at 7 o'clock at the Epicenter Theater. Free, by the way. Susan Saddledoff is the writer, producer, director of Hot Coffee. Bobby Jenkins is an attorney and assistant professor at Charlotte School of Law. And Ted Frank is an adjunct fellow at Manhattan Institute's Center for Legal Policy. I want to give you a chance to chime in on what we were just talking about.
You asked whether coffee had to be 180 degrees, and the answer is yes, if you want it to taste good. It's a chemical reaction. The aromatic oils that make coffee taste good get released at a high temperature.
You can't drink coffee at 180 degrees.
Can I please
answer this question?
Answer the question. If you serve coffee at 140 degrees, like Stella Liebeck's lawyer wanted you to, it doesn't taste very good. That's why people don't buy $30 coffee pots at home, and they buy $100 coffee pots at home, because the $100 coffee pots, coffee makers, serve the coffee at the 180 to 190 degree temperature that the Coffee Manufacturers Association recommends, that makes coffee taste good. Now, consumers can choose to buy lukewarm coffee, and they'll be unhappy with it. Now, when you sell billions of cups of coffee like McDonald's do, will somebody spill it on themselves and hurt themselves? Or will a McDonald's employee spill it on somebody and hurt them? And the answer is yes, occasionally that will happen. It happens approximately 1 in 23 million times, if you believe the statistic of 700 previous incidents. And at the end of the day, it's a matter of consumer choice. Do we let consumers decide for themselves? Yes, I want to have the convenience of coffee in a drive-thru. Yes, I want coffee that tastes good. And that's why every court that looks at this, other than the one in New Mexico, says you do not have a cause of action. I'm not even letting this get to a jury. This suit is completely bogus. And what really surprises me is that when confronted with this ridiculous result in the Stella Liebeck hot coffee case, the trial lawyers didn't just say, yeah, sometimes the court system gets it wrong. And instead, they have generated this whole cottage industry, including whole movies, trying to defend what is every common sense person.
But is that not a response? Is that not a response to what's been going on politically in the country at the same time? And I think you're. I think it would be accurate to say that this case fueled some of that side of the argument for tort reform. If the jury makes a bad decision, if the judge makes a bad decision, in this particular case, or in several particular cases, does it mean you throw out the whole baby with the bathwater and tear up the system?
And you shouldn't. But on the other hand, what you can do is you can have reforms that minimize the effect of any one bad jury mistake.
Well,
if you have let me finish. If you have 15 lawsuits against a car company complaining you have manufactured an SUV, and because an SUV has a higher wheelbase because you want to be able to take it off-road, then nobody ever actually takes their SUVs off-road anymore. And because of that, it has a higher center of gravity, so it's more unsafe in some accidents and more safe in other accidents. But in one particular subset of accidents, it's unsafe. And you present that to a jury, and the first 14 juries say, no, the car company didn't do anything wrong. And the 15th jury says, no, you're liable for $200 million. That 15th jury has essentially undone everything the first 14 juries have
No,
done.
That's not correct, Mr. Frank. The way that our jury system works is that each case is evaluated on its individual facts. Not all the facts in every hot coffee case are going to be exactly the same. That's why we have a jury. The jury hears both sides of the jury
works.
Hears
Just
both sides of the issue and what the facts are, and then they
no
come up with a verdict.
Hold on for just a second. Everybody's talking at the same time. And Bobby Jenkins, we have a basic fundamental difference about how the jury system works here in this conversation. I want to hear from you. Who's right? Who's wrong? How does the jury system – how is it supposed to work?
Well, the fundamental question here, the overriding question, and it was touched on by both sides, is not whether the McDonald's coffee case was correctly decided by the jury or whether the judge in that particular state applied the law correctly. The question is, do we take that result, even if you want to say that it was wrong on all levels, and as you said, change the entire system as opposed to just letting it be the system working and the system working in a way that maybe we don't agree with, but we don't then start infringing on rights. Now, the 14, I will strongly disagree with the idea that if 14 prior juries decide one way and the 15th decides another, that the 15th has gone off in some crazy direction. What you teach all law students is that we use terms like reasonableness and negligence and foreseeability is because we can't define every conceivable circumstance. So we use these general principles and then ask the jury to apply the facts to the law. So there is no basis, a reasonable basis, to say that 14 juries deciding one way means the 15th jury decided completely. Unless you're arguing the law.
Let's move beyond the coffee issue, because one of the things that this case brought to light, it kind of added fuel to the fire of tort reform, and people began to see tort reform as something that maybe should be done, given the fact that we have an evidence in our opinions of frivolity in with regard to jury awards in lawsuits. Tort reform has led to capping certain rewards. You can't go above a certain number. And you have an instance in this film about a family of four. They had twin sons. One of the twins was born with a severe brain damage, complications resulting from pregnancy and delivery, and negligence on the part of a doctor who had evidently been negligent before, and on the part of the hospital where she went to have a quick delivery because they had to deliver to prevent this from happening, and it didn't happen. The jury awarded them a significant amount of money. It was amount of money that was supposed to help pay for this child's care for the rest of their life. And yet that particular state had to put a cap on that. So the judge reduced the award to the amount of the cap.
If I can break in that one particular law I disagree with. I think that was a bad law. I don't think you should cap economic damages. There are ways to cap damages so that the jury system is appropriately constrained and that you don't have runaway verdicts, but you should not cap people's actual damages. But go ahead.
And that's happening now in four states where actual damages, including medical bills and wage loss, are capped by the legislature.
And I disagree with those four states.
So is that an unintended consequence of tort reform?
I think there are people who take the opportunity and that you have this backlash against what has been a very bad set of abuses in the judicial system. And sometimes special interests ask for too much, and they don't ask to make the system right. They ask to swing it too far the other way, and I disagree with that. I want the system
well,
to be
well, then that gets us back to this idea of agreeing to arbitrary, mandatory arbitration in case you have a dispute with somebody you're doing business with, and you can't buy the product or do business with them unless you agree to mandatory arbitration. You are signing away your rights. Isn't that tipping the scale?
You're not signing away anything. You are engaging in freedom of contract, something that the trial lawyers want to take away from you.
But you don't have a freedom, Mr. Frank, when you use a credit card. You can't. Can I just say one thing, please? When you use a credit card right now, you cannot get a credit card or use a cell phone unless you agree to mandatory arbitration. There is no cell phone agreement that exists that doesn't have a mandatory arbitration clause. And so you can't get a cell phone as a consumer unless you agree to give up your constitutional rights to access the court system. And so don't say that, you know, we have a choice. We don't have a choice.
First of all, you can get a Virgin cell phone without an arbitration clause. And if Virgin thought that they could sell more cell phones by saying, we don't have arbitration clauses, they would do that, and they don't. And that's because consumers would rather have the lower prices than the right to give money to class action lawyers.
It's because consumers don't have any idea what mandatory arbitration is or what it's going to mean until they have a dispute.
Well,
and they're signing away their rights before they ever know they're ever going to have a dispute.
You can start the Susan Saladoff cell phone company and advertise to consumers, we don't have mandatory arbitration. You should go with us. And the fact is, you wouldn't get any customers that
way. In truth, the average person cannot do that. You cannot compete with Verizon or AT&T because they have the infrastructure and the money to build that infrastructure, which dates back hundreds of years. It would take you 100 years to do that.
I don't think cell phone infrastructure dates back hundreds of years. But
the capital required to build the infrastructure to make your cell phones work was built on the wired telephone industry, which dates back to 1890.
We have a competitive system. If a company thought they could get more customers by giving them the right to engage in expensive litigation that raises costs for all customers and charge them a higher price for that and get more customers for that, they would do that. And the reason we have the mandatory arbitration is because the mandatory arbitration, by allowing consumers to pre-commit in advance that they won't bring an expensive class action that doesn't benefit anybody except the lawyers, they can save money, they can reduce the cost, and the consumers would rather have the lower cost.
Is it your assertion?
The lawyers are fighting so hard. For example, eBay is now having a voluntary pre-commitment to mandatory arbitration. They're letting their customers know, you can opt out. If you don't want the mandatory arbitration, you can opt out of it. And the trial lawyers are throwing a fit because they know that if 90%
stop making this about trial lawyers. This is about consumers, not lawyers. You always want to make it about the lawyers, but it's about us. It's about the people who are listening to this program.
She brings up an interesting point. No, she brings up an interesting point because there is a political aspect to this, and we know that in politics there are certain key words that are being used by politicians to get a certain reaction from voters. And when we hear the term trial lawyers, bad. That's the image that we get in our heads. And that partly comes from people like Karl Rove, who admits it freely.
And from Ted Frank, who does it all the time in his blogging. I mean, this is their modus operandi to continually repeat over and over again the same things: frivolous lawsuit, greedy trial lawyer, jackpot justice. This is how it's been done for 25 and 30 years.
And in your film, both Karl Rove and George W. Bush talk about the idea of repeating something over and over and over. In George Bush's case, so that it will sink into the people that he's talking to. In Karl Rove's point of view, so that it becomes true in their minds. But
that you're complaining about these buzzwords and you're throwing Karl Rove and George W. Bush tort reform.
Yes, it works both ways, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, it does.
Yeah.
Well, look, watch the movie.
But that does not negate the fact that this movie and your point of view in this movie is about the consumer.
That's right, because it's the consumers, the people who are listening to this program right now are probably not CEOs or major shareholders of large corporations. They're probably you and me who buy cell phones and who buy products and who want to have clean air and clean water. And we, the consumers and general population, we have to be able to have a court system to hold wrongdoers accountable when they make products that are harmful to us, when they pollute our waters and streams. And if we can't do that in our civil courts, we've lost our rights completely because there's no other place where that's going to happen.
Ted Frank.
Well, first of all, no mandatory arbitration clause precludes somebody from suing over a dangerous product in the court system. So that's just a fiction, and you're conflating two separate issues when you complain about citizens having the rights to sue over dangerous products and mandatory arbitration, because no mandatory arbitration.
The movie actually has four storylines, and so there are four storylines about how we're giving up our rights. The mandatory arbitration clauses are just one of them.
You change the subject to another one. But at the same time, tort reform is good for consumers. Right now, our litigation system is twice as expensive as that of any other country in the Western industrialized world, and that is only the direct cost. The indirect costs are even higher. We don't see the products that aren't being developed. We don't see the doctors who quit their practice.
This is more propaganda.
It's wonderful that
Well, he brings up in a paper that he wrote for the American Enterprise Institute that our nation's tort system is substantially more expensive than that of other nations, features unique to the United States unbounded non-economic damages, a broader use of punitive damages, contingent fees of a percentage of recovery, the lack of loser pays, which I think maybe the loser ought to pay if they bring in a frivolous lawsuit. Extraordinarily broad discovery, class action litigation, the use of speculative and non-scientific expert testimony in some courts all raise court costs tremendously. Is he wrong, Bobby?
Again, there are buzzwords in there. The idea of frivolous lawsuits and should the loser pay if there's a frivolous lawsuit. But there are already systems in place where litigants could be forced or could be faced with costs or sanctions if frivolous lawsuits allow me to never use the word frivolous lawsuit. No one can define a frivolous lawsuit to begin with. Most defense counsel define a frivolous lawsuit as the one that the plaintiff loses, even though that doesn't make it frivolous. The other issue we face here and in trying to have this argument is we tend to mix apples, oranges, and bananas. The class action argument is totally separate from, to me, at least in terms of public policy, maybe not in terms of constitutional rights, but in terms of public policy from a consumer transaction, from a tort reform that relates to personal injury and preventing someone. Our system may be more expensive. When you look at economic damages and the recovery of economic damages, our healthcare system is also more expensive than most healthcare systems in the world. So it only fits, then, that if someone's injured in this country, the cost of healthcare is much higher than in other countries in the world. So the cost of dealing with that damage is going to be much higher.
Driving the difference in
well, if you say economic damages are too high, it is in part due to the fact that that our economic damages are based on lost wages, which we may have higher wages, on medical expenses incurred, which we have a very expensive medical care system, and it costs money to deal with people in that country.
And with that, we have to stop because we are out of time. Bobby Jenkins is an attorney, assistant professor at the Charlotte School of Law. Ted Frank, adjunct fellow with the Manhattan Institute's Center for Legal Policy and a former fellow with the American Enterprise Institute. And Susan Saladoff, attorney, producer, director of Hot Coffee, which will be screened tonight at 7 at Epicenter. It's an HBO film, an HBO documentary.
And I'll be there.
And it will be free, and she will be there tonight. Thank you all for the hour. I think we resolved nothing, but it was an interesting conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me.